Good evening. It's Saturday, September 3rd, 2022. Coming up on tonight's news, Kaiser mental health care professionals who are members of NUHW, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, say they are anxiously waiting for Kaiser to get back to the bargaining table so that they can get back to their patients.
I don't want to be doing this, but, you know, there's a point at which, like, you have to make choices, and, you know, when you're trying to do what's in the best interest of people, you know, what's really, really in the best interest. You have to fight.
A year after the United States has withdrawn from Afghanistan, many are taking note of the discrepancy in the ways evacuees from Afghanistan and Ukraine are being cared for by the United States.
In more than a year, only about 70,000 Afghans have been evacuated. But 3 months, more than 100,000 Ukrainians have been evacuated.
As pedestrian deaths are at a 40-year high in the United States, members of a Contra Costa County community gather to acknowledge the one-year anniversary of the death of a crossing guard who died helping children cross the street to get home from school.
One of them, the emergency cops, he came to me and he says, "Are you Ashley's mom?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, I want to tell you this. He says, "You know, I'm sorry your son died, but he died a hero. If it wasn't for him, my little girl would have been dead." And he showed me a picture of his little girl. You know, and that gave me some peace because I figured, you know, he saved some lives.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Kaiser Permanente's mental health staff, who are members of NUHW, National Union of Healthcare Workers, have been on strike since August 15th. Making this one of the longest healthcare strikes in U.S. history. Mental health professionals ranging from psychologists to social workers are calling on Kaiser to do better for their patients, who they say need consistent and regular access to mental health care. The staff say they can't do this when they're understaffed and overworked. I spoke with mental health care workers and patients on the picket line outside of Walnut Creek on Friday.
I've called the main mental health number 3 times and said, "Hi, this is me. Here's how I'm impacted. Here's my medical record number. I need help. What am I supposed to do?" They never called back.
That's Laura Bramble. She's one of the thousands of Kaiser Permanente's patients going without access to mental health care at this time.
I am in case management, which means I have a therapist that I was fortunate enough to see twice a week. I acknowledge that I have an extraordinary benefit. That's the level of care that we agreed that is best for me. And I have now gone, I've missed, I think, 6 or 7 appointments that would have happened if the strike hadn't happened. And this is not to say that I'm not holding my therapist at fault. You know, she's not the blame. This is because Kaiser cannot or will not put the emphasis on mental health that it does on all the other types of care. And it's not fair. It's not right. And people like me are left hurting. And I can't even begin to think about what it's like for the people that were waiting for appointments and had been waiting and are still not in the system.
Carissa Tom is the organizing coordinator with NUHW, or the National Union of Healthcare Workers. Even though right now patients like Laura Bramble are hurting, Tom says this strike is all about patient care.
Right before our members decided to go out on strike, Kaiser actually tried to offer like a last minute deal that was a big bump in wages but didn't address any of the patient care issues, and essentially, you know, told our members that we can give you this, if you accept it, don't tell anybody about it. And obviously our members felt that that was a bribe, that was hush money. You've heard from so many other people, I'm sure, right, that they're talking about, they're not on strike for wages, they're not on strike for the economics, they're on strike because they want better patient care. And so those are really the main things on the table of really getting Kaiser to commit to more incentives for recruitment and retention, as well as committing to hiring more staff and even creating a staffing committee that so far they've balked at. So those are some of the main issues that our members are out on strike for.
So this is literally a case where maybe they were offered more than they were asking for?
Yeah, absolutely. Essentially, Kaiser tried to throw money at our members, in order to try to avert a strike. And our members said, this is not what this is about. It has been and always has been this, you know, about patient care. This strike, it didn't come out of nowhere. It's the culmination of at least 12 years of struggle, specifically on this issue. You know, our members have been doing that through contract enforcement, through previous strikes that they've been on. Our union and our members really led the fight on passing SB 221, which is holding primarily Kaiser, because they're the biggest name in the game, right? Accountable to actually seeing patients on a more frequent notice, right, within those 10 days, as well as the most recent passage of SB 855, which would increase the fines that Kaiser gets per incident where patients are not getting seen, from $2,500 to $25,000. And that passed the state house last week, and it's kind of sitting on Governor Newsom's desk waiting to be signed.
Lori Ono is a case manager in intensive services at Kaiser Permanente, who has worked in mental health services for more than 2 decades. Ono says she can't wait to get back to her patients, but in order to give them the kind of care they need and deserve, she and her colleagues are taking a stand.
I've worked in different positions. So I worked in the intensive outpatient program for a period of time, and then for about 10 years I was a generalist. So I saw anybody who came in who was an adult, and I left that position for this very reason that we're out here, because it's kind of like stuffing a trash bag. If you just keep stuffing the trash bag without emptying it, you're going to have a big blast of the trash bag, right? And that's what happens, is that people essentially can't do it. It's just like you keep getting more and more patients in your schedule, but people aren't leaving. And then you get complicated people, and they're definitely not leaving, and they need more support. And when I was in that position, I saw people regularly every 2 months. So once I did an intake with them, I could not see them for another 2 months.
And what was that like for you?
It was horrible. It was horrible. It was stressful. It was concerning. You know, I did my best to try to kind of like contain what their needs were. And I started just being incredibly transparent. And I'd say, look, you know, you call me, let me know if you need something or whatever, but this is what I can do.
Your hands are kind of tied, right?
Oh, completely, like completely tied. And so, you know, the thing that they want us to do is they want us to have the patient call the main number and talk to somebody. So,
not you.
Well, I mean, no, actually they would actually have us take care of it. So we had to find time to, in our schedule, like whatever time we didn't have to do that. And I would regularly spend 1 to 2 hours a night just completing paperwork, and then 4 to 5 hours on the weekend just to complete paperwork.
These are hours that you're not compensated for.
I wasn't compensated at all. And then the other thing is, let's say that I did happen to finish remarkably, or I had something I needed to go to, they would not let me leave a little early, knowing that I would get my job done. You know, it's like, it was just not a professional environment. And it's still not a professional environment in that way. They treat us like factory workers.
What keeps you at Kaiser?
I've been here for 22 years. you know, the team, the people that I work with, the patients, I have a heart for the patients. And I actually worry, you know, about the people that I work with that, you know.
This makes me emotional.
Yeah, I mean.
Emotional.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to get the care that they need.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or a message you'd like to leave with the patients who you can't see right now?
I'm pretty torn around that, because I know I'm doing this for them, but I also know how hard it is on them. So
it hurts you to not be able to care for them, right?
Yeah, it hurts a lot. I don't want to be doing this, but you know, there's a point at which, like, you have to make choices, and, you know, when you're trying to do what's in the best interest of people, you know, what's really, really in the best interest, you have to fight. So that's what I would say.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Patty Papanay is a per diem marriage and family therapist who works in the chemical dependency unit. But in order for mental health professionals to provide the kind of care that Kaiser patients deserve, they need to be taken better care of.
I know that the people that I work with, they've got all this personal time off, PTO and vacation, and there's nobody to fill in for them. So they're stuck, and they're begging their other colleagues to try to fill in for them, who are also working over, you know, a full period, and they have families and children, and there's nobody to help. I've been the only per diem person to jump in and help people on vacation or take a day off to take their, you know, pregnant wife to the doctor or whatever. It's just, it has not been amenable to a balance of work and family life.
The staff on strike say that Kaiser members who need care should continue to seek it. Mental health patients at Kaiser whose appointments have been canceled can call 1-888-466-2219 to report that. Strikers also say that you can support them by sharing time with them on the picket lines, contributing to their fund while they're out of work, and amplifying their cause. The civil war in Ethiopia resumed on August 24th with the heaviest fighting in the disputed territory that most Ethiopians call Wolkite. But the secessionist Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, call Western Tigray. On the morning that the fighting began, the TPLF broke into a World Food Program warehouse and stole 12 fuel tanker trucks containing 570,000 liters of fuel. KPFA's Ann Garrison has the story.
World Food Program Chief David Beasley reacted to the fuel theft in shock. Hours ago, he tweeted, Tigrayan authorities stole 570,000 liters of fuel for WFP operations in Tigray. Millions will starve if we do not have fuel to deliver food. This is outrageous and disgraceful. We demand return of this fuel now. Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, included more detail in his August 24 briefing.
This morning on August 24th, World Food Program warehouse in Mekele was forcibly entered by Tigrayan forces who took 12 fuel trucks, tankers, with 570,000 liters of fuel. The team on the ground unsuccessfully tried to prevent this looting. These stocks of fuel were to be used solely for humanitarian purposes with the distribution of food, fertilizer, and other emergency relief items. This loss of fuel will impact humanitarian operations in supporting communities in all of northern Ethiopia. We condemn any looting or confiscation of humanitarian goods or humanitarian premises. And we call on all parties to uphold their obligations under international humanitarian law and to respect humanitarian personnel, activities, assets, and goods.
That was Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, on the TPLF theft of 570,000 liters of fuel intended for delivery of food and other humanitarian aid in Tigray region, Ethiopia. As of September 3rd, there are no reports that the TPLF has returned the fuel to the World Food Program. For the last 2 years, the TPLF has accused the Ethiopian federal government of blocking food aid to Tigray and described the situation as, quote, a siege, unquote. More on this story can be found on The Gray Zone, thegrayzone.com. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
It's been a year since the United States troops withdrew from Afghanistan. The departure of the last U.S. troops left the country in a humanitarian crisis and marked a turning point in the Biden administration's foreign policy in the region. Many critics are now noting the difference in the way that the United States is responding to Afghan evacuees and evacuees from the Ukraine. KPFA's Lola Akamu has more.
When the last U.S. troops boarded planes at the Kabul International Airport, it was a symbolic end to the last chapter in the decades-long U.S.-Afghanistan war. But no one could have predicted the chaos that ensued afterwards as images of desperate Afghan civilians storming the airport hoping to escape the country was seared into the minds of many throughout the world. The Taliban have since taken over and reversed some of the gains that the United States and its allies worked to implement in the country. The country has been facing economic collapse, and many leaders have criticized President Biden's handling of the U.S. exit. Najib Azad is a former spokesperson for former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and is the author of Beyond Evacuation. He said the United States needs to do more for Afghan refugees.
You know, I do appreciate that the U.S. has been hosting the Ukrainian evacuees or refugees in the past 5-6 months. But honestly speaking, Ukrainians did not fight the American war, but Afghans fought the American war for 2 decades, and they are still in numbers. They are less than the Ukrainians have been evacuated in the United States. And so that's what the policy should be considered. I do appreciate that more and more in thousands or tens of thousands of Ukrainians should be evacuated. But in the Afghan case, it is not taken in consideration. Even the Senate or the Congress is not approving those mandates or laws for the Afghans evacuees. So in overall picture, it was Afghans who fought the American war for 20 years, and they deserve to be on the top of the list, which is not, unfortunately.
Azad says the U.S. should reassess the frozen assets of the Afghan people.
The states, the governments, they usually have a big amount of dollars or kind of gold or things like that, you know, to make sure that the international transaction goes smoothly. So that capital of about $9 to $10 billion that has been frozen by the U.S. is just because to keep stable the Afghan currency and make sure that the international transaction goes through. It is the Afghan government's money. It is the Afghan people's money. It is not the Taliban money, though. So that has been frozen. They, like I said before, yeah, the U.S. cannot or should not give an access to Taliban to this money, but it should be still in the U.S. Banks that makes sure the international transaction goes smoothly to Afghanistan, which really helps the Afghans daily life there.
Again, that was Najib Azad, former spokesperson for Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
You're listening to 94.1 FM KPFA in Berkeley, 88.1 FM in Fresno, 97.5 FM K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Nearly 100 people gathered in Lafayette last night for the unveiling of a plaque in memory of 45-year-old Ashley Diaz. Last year, on September 8th, Diaz became a statistic when he was working as a crossing guard outside of Stanley Middle School in Lafayette. Diaz is one of some 7,485 pedestrians who were killed in the United States in 2021. That's the highest number of pedestrian deaths in the U.S. that we've seen in more than 40 years. The crowd of city officials, concerned community members, family, and friends of Ashley Diaz had one simple message on Friday evening that they said can curb the statistics so that other families and communities can stay intact.
You know, pay attention to your surroundings and just keep our streets safe. That's all I ask.
That's 11-year-old Angelique Diaz-Vani, the niece of Ashley Diaz, who now attends Stanley Middle School and passes the crosswalk each day where her uncle was run down by a vehicle that 79-year-old Phyllis Meehan was driving when picking up her grandson. Meehan pleaded no contest but was sentenced to probation and community service. Angelique says that although her uncle is gone, she remembers him fondly.
I don't really show emotion, you know, I just, you know, you gotta let go whatever in the past. You gotta move on in life.
Yeah. What was your favorite memory of him?
We went on many hikes. We did, went on many taste tests, just, you know.
Taste testing? What did you taste?
Lots of yogurt, yeah.
Ashley Diaz's mother, Gloria Diaz, is advocating for September 8th, the day that her son joined the pedestrian fatality statistics, to be designated as School Safety Day in memory of her late son. Although a year has passed, Gloria says she remembers her son's last day vividly.
I used to depend on Ashley for so many things. He would cook me meals, he would, you know, dish them out like it was professional, you know, on a plate. He would, you know, take me to my doctor's appointments. He would accompany me here, there. And, you know, I keep waiting.
He was your caretaker in part, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I had a colon collapse in last year after I took the second vaccine. And that's the reason Ashley came to live with us, so he could take me. Because my husband, you know, he's aged and he cannot really do the stuff that a younger person could do. So Ashley was, like, you know, there.
So he moved back to take care of you?
Yeah.
And where did he move back from?
San Francisco. He worked in biotech in South, you know, South City. And he, you know, and he was working, like, because of COVID, he was working, you know, online. And so he said, okay, you'll come here, take me to doctor's appointment. And the school just said that, hey, we need a volunteer, we're short staff, can you help? And he said, fine. And
so Wednesday morning he left and he said...
Wednesday afternoon. We had lunch. He, it was about 3:15. And he said, Mom, see you in a bit. And I keep waiting. I keep waiting for that doorbell. I keep waiting for the sound of his laughter and to just come by.
And then how did you learn? Like, what was that? Do you remember? Like, how did you get the news?
I got the news. It was horrible. I kept saying, hey, I kept looking at my time and says at 3:15, Ashley should have been here. And he didn't. Then I get a call from John Muir Hospital. And they said, is your son Ashley Diaz? And I said, is he okay? Is everything okay? And they said, no. But they said, come to the hospital. And then, you know, we drove like crazy. You know, and my son was with me, Trevor. So he came in the car with us and he drove us. And, you know, he said, Mom, it's not good. And I said, why? He said, when the hospital calls you and tells you, you know, come to meet them, that means something is wrong and something's happened to Ashley. And I said, no, no, no. But when I went there, the social worker came to meet me and she took us to a room. And my daughter, Vanessa, beat me to, you know, and she was sobbing hysterically. And when I went there, she said, Mom, he is gone. I said, who is gone? She said, Mom, Ashley is gone. I said, No, Vanessa, you're making a mistake. Ashley is not gone, he said. Then later on, the social worker came to me and she said, you want to come upstairs and identify the body? And I guess I had to go up. His body was covered. And they took it up and it was my Ashley. It broke my heart. And, you know, under the covers, I put my hand and his body was still warm. But I found it was all bruised up. And then the guy for the, you know, when the guys were coming to take them, no, while I was there, one of them, the emergency cops, he came to me and he says, are you Ashley's mom? And I said, yeah. He says, I want to tell you this. He says, you know, I'm sorry your son died, but he died a hero. If it wasn't for him, my little girl would have been dead. And he showed me a picture of his little girl. You know, and that gave me some peace because I figured, you know, he saved some lives.
Kieran Guller, a friend and classmate of Ashley Diaz, flew in from Arizona to be a part of the ceremony to unveil the plaque. Well, Ashley Diaz has literally become a poster child for slowing down. Guller says he wants them to be remembered for more than that.
I came here first grade after moving around a lot, never really planted roots, found some friends and it was good. I thought life was good at that point, but when I met Ashley, it was pretty much life-changing because there's a bond that's created and it's very hard to describe, but it's really, you feel like you found your home. When my mom died, we lost most of our money. And we had to move out to Concord, but my dad fought to keep me in the school system. And he kept me in the school system, but it was difficult because one, we traveled and it was a cliquey society. Like you didn't have to have money to be here and people weren't mean, but it was difficult to keep pace. Like you can't do the things that they do. You can't go and spend the money that they have. You look at your house and it's not the same as their house. And Ashley's family just opened the doors. I didn't feel any difference between my family and his family ever. It didn't matter. Didn't matter I was poor. Didn't matter that he had more than I did. And he never put money above his friendship. Money didn't actually matter when it came to us.
Lafayette City Attorney Mala Subramanian, who worked closely with the Diaz family to craft a memorial plaque for Ashley Diaz, says she hopes everyone will find resonance in the theme of slowing down, not just for driving, but for the ways in which we live our lives.
What the Diaz family wanted on the plaque, I mean, it applies to drivers, but I think it applies generally, is the please slow down. I think that theme in life in general is good.
That was the Lafayette City Attorney speaking about the memorial for Ashley Diaz. And the weather. In the San Francisco Bay Area, lows of around 60 degrees tonight and highs in the 90s tomorrow. In the Fresno-San Joaquin area, lows in the mid-70s tonight and highs topping 100 degrees tomorrow. There's an excessive heat warning in effect until Tuesday for the entire Bay Area, so please remember to stay hydrated and stay safe. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Lola Akamu, Diana Kapp-Cabin, and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.